are Jackson B. Archer and Samuel Wanacott to talk about localism. Sam has some points of contention with, you know, some of the ideals of localism, or maybe not the ideals, but rather how well is this worked in practice. So I'm going to let Jackson present a small, concise case for localism and let Sam talk about any issues he may have with that.
All right. Thanks, Tate. Well, I guess first off, I'll say that my main interest in localism is political, mainly over economic or sort of other things, maybe your food concerns or stuff like that. So my main concern is with political localism and small scale polities and the decentralization that we would have to, most of the world would have to go through in order to see that. So I would first off say, I think when you're doing anything in the style of a debate, it's good to know where the burden of proof lies, or where your starting point is. And I would say the burden of proof is on, not on those who wish to see smaller scale political order, but those who think it is large. And that might seem like a somewhat difficult position to take because of the obvious nature of the world we live in today is with very large states that seem to dominate, and in international affairs, of course, they do. However, most of human history has clearly been characterized by small states, and in most of the flourishing, I think, has taken place in polities that were very small. So we can point to ancient Greece. Athens was somewhere between 1 and 200,000 people and produced a very high level of civilization. Florence was around, I believe, 50,000 during the Renaissance and produced incredible genius on many fronts, from art and literature to philosophy and so on. So we don't need very large scale political orders to produce human excellence. But there are, of course, concerns about being small. The main one, I think, being security. And so what we can do about that, there's different thoughts. But I think the traditional answer in the West, going back all the way to the ancient Greeks, is by federation. So the tiny Greek civilization of about 8 million was able to fend off the Persian Empire of some 40 million, I believe. Might check my facts on that, but a much larger Persian Empire, and you would think that the Persian Empire would just come in and pick off these little Greek city-states, the average size being 6 to 10,000 or so. I mean, most of them are much smaller than Athens. And you would think they would just come in and run them over, but through federation, the Greek city-states were able to band together and fight off the Persian Empire. And then, of course, this is not to dismiss that then not very much later after that, there was a what you might call a civil war or something, a big civilizational clash in the Peloponnesian War. So federation's not foolproof by any means, but it provides a way to address most of the concerns, the security concern anyway, while maintaining the small level of government. And I guess maybe I should say why I think, aside from, well, I guess I've said why I don't think large scale are necessary, but maybe I should say why I think a small scale is a positive good too. And I think on that front, I would say that self-government is not possible beyond a certain scale of human interaction. In other words, human beings by nature being limited in so many ways, there's a natural limit to the human capacities of memory and perception of interaction. There are many Americans, for example, who have traveled the entire country and been in all 50 states, but that's far from the norm. And I certainly don't pay attention to the day-to-day doings in New York and Georgia and Texas or many of the other states, for example. And I think that's probably true of most Americans. Many don't even pay attention to their own local affairs, sadly. I think Tocqueville, Alexis de Tocqueville, was right on point when he identified the New England township as being the real center of self-government. Tocqueville basically argues that he starts off by saying that the township in New England at that time in the 1830s and 40s was basically, he calls it the natural political association. In other words, this is the very smallest scale where some kind of political interaction is unavoidable. And for Tocqueville, you don't count as having a true spirit of liberty unless people are involved at that level, given the natural limits of human beings, of our memory, perception, and other capacities. I think it's easy to see why participation on that level of things that are very close around you is probably is about the only real scale that you can have true popular government. In other words, the average person can participate without having to be a specialist of any kind, a lawyer or a historian or anything like that. Just your average person can participate if things are small. When things get very large, I mean, even out to, well, probably, I mean, I don't know exactly what the number would be, but certainly 300 million people, it just becomes very difficult for any one person, even a specialist, to take hold of all of the problems and issues that face a polity. So with that sort of scattered and broken introduction to how I'm thinking about localism, I will happily turn it over.
All right, Sam, you have anything to say to that?
Well, I think that Jackson gave a very compelling view of what he sees as localism, and there's not a lot that I take issue with. I guess one issue that I see and that I find problematic is a preoccupation with size. Well, so looking at the size of the polity is not a bad thing, I think. And I think it's clearly the case that you can, you know, these things don't scale up infinitely. A world government would obviously not be a good idea. But I think there's another issue we might want to look at, which is the place of the individual in all of this. I think when you look at the American system of government, there was certainly a desire to see the majority of the functions of government taking place or done at the state or local level, and probably preferably the smaller you go, the better. But those local levels can be powerful, and they can impact people's lives in a myriad of ways. So one concern I would have is just, you know, where do the checks and balances come into place? You have these, you know, multiple small cities or villages or towns, and presumably there can be some voting with your feet that takes place. But I think there are many examples in history where small areas, small political centers have been as tyrannical as large ones, if not more so. So that's one concern I have. You mentioned security. I think potentially, you know, that could be solved by federation. I guess one good example of where we essentially had a system like that was the Articles of Confederation, and the lack of a mechanism by which state or the little places could be compelled to say act in the common good, say for defense purposes, is I think one of the reasons why some of the founding generation had problems with that. Certainly we don't have competing opposite views of how humans should interact.
I think the concern about, I mean, the question of individual human liberty is obviously a huge question, and I think you're very right to raise the concern that small units can be just as oppressive as larger ones. That's very much a valid concern. We have to look at, we can't just dismiss that. So that's a good point. And of course, you brought up voting with your feet, which of course it's easier to do when units are smaller. The question of individual liberty, though, I guess I would just add that I think a key component, I mean, I guess, I suppose I would say a person could, you could ask, what is the value of individual liberty? I don't think that's I think that's a question worth considering. And there's there's a core, I mean, this is a philosophical can of worms that could go many different directions. But the way I'm thinking about that has certainly impacted how I think about localism and why I'm in favor of decentralization. And I guess I would say the value of individual liberty is for human beings to flourish. That's no surprise. But I think human beings flourish mainly through the societies and associations that they identify with and belong to. Those are the things I think really at core can give a person real meaning. And I suppose that may or may not be contentious for our purposes today, but for those who see individual liberty as not an end in itself, but a constitutive means, a necessary component of flourishing by social interaction and how we in identity as well, then again it goes back to the presumption that orders ought to be small, and the concern there just being that larger orders will centralize, will flatten out, will sort of mash over these smaller associations. And of course, we can point to the fraternal societies and so on in American history that were were more or less legislated out of existence. The functions were, in other words, they served as health cooperatives, a kind of sort of voluntary insurance pools. They functioned in those ways, and that function was legislated more or less out of existence at the federal and state levels. So, and that's just one example. But, and see, then you have that, that's of course would affect the community itself, because then if there's not a function, if there's not something for people to do when they come together, then they just won't come together and associate. They won't associate. So we'll have atomized individuals. But again, I think that only goes far enough to place the burden of proof again, to go back to that question and say the presumption really ought to be for small states over larger ones.
Yeah. Okay. So I guess with the idea of that people, you know, come together and they create these organizations and institutions and, you know, fraternal societies and all of these ways in which we sort of voluntarily stop being individuals and become part of some, you know, larger whole community and so forth. I guess I'm not entirely sure why that would be mutually exclusive with a larger overarching constitution that attempts to put checks and balances on, you know, at all levels of the government. Now, granted, it's true that many of these fraternal societies were legislated out of existence, so that sort of runs counter to the point I'm making. But I mean, I think in any political system, things are going to be messy. The reason we might have multiple layers of government is, well, there are multiple reasons for that, but one of them is so that there are some checks and balances. So it seems to me that so long as you have some framework that allows for human liberty, you will have those voluntary organizations that, you know, sort of spontaneously, to use Hayek's phrase, spontaneously arise. So I don't see why the very necessary voluntary orders that we create is, you know, mutually exclusive with a larger framework of government that ensures that at the local level those don't become tyrannical. Yes, it's true that there was some legislation that stopped some of those fraternal orders and so forth were legislated out of existence, which is true. But there's no logical reason why that hadn't happened. It could very well be the case that those fraternal societies could have continued growing and developing, had some different things been done in politics, different choices been made. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. I try to point out that there's not any necessary connection between centralizing and then a sort of hollowing out, the flattening out of these smaller, more nuanced associations that I would argue give more meaning to human flourishing, human life. But of course, that we have seen it historically. It's hard to point to situations in which that doesn't happen. There is, however, I think, one excellent example of that, and that is Switzerland, having, I believe, composed of 26 cantons, the smallest being a population of about 10,000, I think, and cannot seem to remember how large the largest is. And of course, the territory is pretty diverse, populated by people speaking three different languages, three or four. And of course, they managed to sort of hold together. I guess when we're talking about the possibility of having a larger, because that makes sense if you have small units stepping on individual liberties, well, couldn't we go to a larger scale and correct these things? And to a large degree, that is where larger units derive their legitimacy. In other words, you can go back to the feudal order and look at the dukes and the lords and so on, the smaller estates really trampling on people, and of course people would rally to the king, and that of course increased the king's power. He could centralize, but there was functioning. The king was sort of doing a legitimate service in a sense, because he was intervening to stop these smaller violations. It's important to point out that violations by smaller units tend to empower the larger units, But that you're right to point out, that's not necessarily in itself a bad thing if the larger unit is only acting to protect the smaller ones. But I suppose it just comes down to what kind of association are we going to have? In other words, what are going to be the fundamental guarantees of individual liberty? And they have to be fundamental interests that everyone accepts. So in the case of the United States, our Constitution guarantees that every state will have, I mean, as a condition of being part of the Union, they have to maintain a Republican form of government. That's sort of a baseline. If a state changes its form of government to a principality or papal monarch or something like that, then it could no longer be part of the Union. But the question, though, then is for this kind of association is what happens then? In other words, when one of the parties decides that these fundamental guarantees that we've agreed on, they no longer wish to abide by. In other words, they have their view of their own good and well-being takes a fundamentally different turn. What is the response going to be? And it can be one of two things. It can be further disassociation, or it can be one party essentially dominating the other. So it could be either that party taking over the central government and sort of changing that agreement that we would all have Republican form of government, for example, or it could be the rest of the states ganging up and forcing that one to stay in the game. And so human liberty is sort of, it comes down to the fact that people have incommensurable worldviews in many cases. And so the question is, what do you do with those? And to take another example, I mean, for some people, the abortion is a fundamental human right. The right to the right of a woman to remove an unwanted fetus from her body is a fundamental human right for some. That's part of their worldview. And for others, see that as a fundamental violation of all that is good and decent. So the question then becomes not which view is in favor of – which view is really a better account of human liberty. I mean, that's an important discussion. But the real political question is, what do we do about it? If we have to balance other concerns if we're going to continue to associate together. And if it becomes too – if that form of association for one party or the other becomes too intolerable, then the only right thing to do is to simply go our separate ways. So it's a very difficult thing when we're talking about larger units protecting smaller ones in terms of defending individual liberty and preventing tyranny, because we have to take those sorts of differences into account.
Well, yes. And I mean, not to mention the obvious elephant in the room, which is if you empower a very large, you kind of mentioned it, you know, you empower the overarching political unit, charge that level with being able to swoop in and protect liberties, then, you know, what do you do when that level turns tyrannical? So that's obviously one big concern. So the secession question, which you were getting at, is one I find really interesting. And I guess my view of secession is that it is neither good nor bad, but that it has to be taken on a case-by-case basis. Because when I find that when people talk about the right to self-determination or the right to self-government, mostly a phrase used by the right, what they have in mind is simple majoritarianism. So if a majority of Idaho wants to secede, then that's what should happen. But I think that there are some obvious concerns many people would have with that, which is that, well, why should 51% be that threshold for determining the course millions of people, and including those who don't favor seceding from an established political unit. So like one very contemporary example is Scotland attempting to secede from the UK. There were some questions raised as to why 51% should be that limit that decides whether or not to break free, especially given that in politics, people are often short-sighted. They are they get drummed into a frenzy by short-term gain, and people are susceptible to those strong emotions that may not be looking at the longer term. So I think in theory secession sounds good, because you think, yes, if you have this unanimous decision to break free from a political unit, you have these incommensurate values, then perfect. But what happens when you're dragging along a good number of people who don't want to come along? And I guess that would be a question that I would pose to you. And yeah, I mean, it's a very messy question when you look at it not from a unanimous decision, but from a majoritarian position.
Right, and that's certainly a good concern. Again, the rights of minorities, but of course you have to remember now, if we're just talking about numbers, then I don't exactly know how many Brits there are, but you would be talking about a much larger number if they had forced a majority. I mean, if we suppose that a majority of Scotland did in fact want to secede, then you would of course be talking about, if the UK prevented that, then you would be looking at them stopping a larger number of people, of Scots, from self-determination than the Scots would be stopping themselves. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Well, I should have expounded on this. So just to go back to what I said and stating that I don't see secession as either good or bad, but very depends very much on the context. This is, I think, where you need some sort of value system in place by which to judge whether or not the secession is legitimate or not. And you know, that obviously, like you said, opens up a whole philosophical can of worms. But if the act of secession is, I guess you could say, loosely commensurate with individual liberty, then I think you've got a really good case there, especially if the seceding unit is seceding from a system that's much more tyrannical. But if you have a situation in which one seceding unit is seceding because it wants to trample, say, on the rights of individuals or of, you know, minority groups or whatever it might be, then I think you've got a really problematic situation, because you're essentially furthering the interests of, right, the majority, maybe, and, you know, sometimes maybe it's even a fairly large majority, but you're not protecting individual liberty in that kind of situation. And these are obviously, like, I mean, some of these are very extreme cases, so they're maybe not likely to come up all the time, but that's why I think that secession is not something that can be just given one's blessing. You know, you can't just say yes in you know, all cases secession is this good thing, assuming that the majority, it's acting in the interest of the majority.
Well, yeah, I would have to be in agreement that it would be probably foolish to say that you're in favor of secession all the time, anywhere, without looking at, without giving some weight to prudence at the very least, and individual liberty. But again, I mean, we're looking at, I mean, it's just becomes very difficult to judge in practice if something abstract like liberty is supposed to be the standard, because again, people take very different views. So if the Supreme Court were to be stacked by a Republican president this next term and overturn Roe v. Wade, the backlash from communities who see abortion as a fundamental human right would be acting in the interest of human liberty. And of course, there are many communities who see that as no such thing. Probably good portions of people in Idaho. I mean, they just simply don't see it as an issue of human liberty at all. Of course, we do have to make these judgments ourselves, but I think it's important to give weight to, when you're talking about something like liberty, give weight to the particular concerns of the group that's involved. In other words, even though Idahoans and say even a majority, if I'm not mistaken, of Americans do in fact oppose abortions, of course I don't think the answer would be to then accept that majority's view of individual liberty, which I take would be that abortion has nothing to do with it, so that they would view those claims that abortion is a fundamental human right as being spurious. So it's a difficult thing to suppose liberty as a kind of standard, just because. But then again, I think you're right that it doesn't necessarily follow that we ought to support every secession movement either. I think the concern isn't, I guess I would say, I don't think the most enlightening thing to do is to approach it from a view of liberty, no matter how convinced we might be of our own views, and we ought to be, we ought to have some conviction on that. But still, I would take other more, I guess, sort of realist, that's kind of a dirty word, but I would look at more realist concerns, some things like security and so on, as being primary to anything so abstract as liberty.
I don't know that it's abstract. I mean, certainly there are tough cases like abortion, but in practice you can, and of course there are disagreements about what exactly constitutes liberty, you know, and what, because of course there are many different conceptions of liberty, undoubtedly. I guess, you know, you come to a fork in the road at that point where you can throw out the task of attempting to come to some sort of an understanding of what form of say government or philosophical conception of liberty best allows for human flourishing, and allow any, well, how do I want to say this? I don't know. That just sounds like a very dangerous road to go down, because and I'm okay with, say, balancing individual liberty with some other concerns. But, I mean, the nice thing about individual liberty is that it allows individuals to decide for themselves, whereas if, you know, what their values are in life. But if you take that away, you know, someone is deciding for them. So, I mean, you have to have some basis upon which to judge, right, what best allows for human flourishing. And, you know, it could be tradition, it could be liberty, it could be some sort of communitarian value, but you have to have something, or else you wade into the very muddy waters of, you know, some sort of form of multiculturalism where you cannot pass judgments on people who have different viewpoints. And I'm not, it sounds like a very relativistic way of looking at things.
I mean, I would agree we have to avoid the relativism. That's the, see, it's a very fine line one has to walk. In other words, I agree we have to make these sorts of judgments. We have to have them. Any community or polity of any size has to have some basic convictions by which they are willing to stand, or it, my opinion anyway, that they'll simply fall apart. But we can go too far, too. In other words, we can be so large that we don't have much in common, and we could fall apart that way. In other words, decentralization can prevent that kind of relativism, which I think was a point you were making about the multiculturalism too, if I followed correctly. So I don't want to push relativism. We have to have our convictions, but at the same time we are always confronting the problem that others have their convictions too. And so, you know, balancing that with interests, I mean, Idaho and California will always probably have some kind of mutual interest in defense. In other words, we're on the same continent, we're close enough that we have an interest, it seems, just by our geography, in associating in a ways that will be advantageous for both of us in terms of defense. And you could even say trade as well. That's probably even more so with trade. But the real trick is to associate in ways that allow others to still pursue their conception. So Donald Livingston, if I remember, characterizes federalism as requiring a very high level of civic and moral virtue, because you have to sort of be tolerant of people who have fundamentally different conceptions of the good life and fundamentally different conceptions of human flourishing. And these wholly different ways of life, they go on for generations. So it takes a very high degree of civic virtue to be able to walk that line of associating where it's advantageous and sort of coexisting and not intruding on the other. And of course, the temptation is always for the larger polity to subsume the other one under its interests when there are differences. That's, I think, simply a function of the temptation of vainglory. But does that at all shed light on any concerns?
Yeah, I think it does. I guess in my closing remarks, I would just make the point that I would want to focus, I guess, more on limiting government at all levels, and not so much on the particular size, geographically or otherwise, of the government. And if we're going to take a realist position, politics is messy, and in many ways, the American system of government, maybe more than any other, has allowed for people to coexist with different values. Although, of course, there are the dangers of national legislation, with abortion or gay marriage or whatever it may be.
I think that's really the best way to look at it is, first of all, recognizing that it's messy, and it is true that the American system has allowed communities to a high level of self-determination, relatively speaking, up until very recent. The only place where where it really sort of becomes a concern for me is just on those fundamental issues, if we're talking about gay marriage or abortion, where it affects a fundamental view of human good and flourishing. Those are the particular issues where I think centralism is particularly dangerous, but those issues are few and far between, and thankfully they aren't decided necessarily by majorities more often than not the Supreme Court. But again, it's not so much better when it's a decision that some group fundamentally disagrees with.